Okay, so you've got Toyota are the biggest car manufacturers in the world. Babies are born without kneecaps, they don't appear until they're 2 to 6 years old. The toothbrush was invented in 1598. On average, women speak 7,000 to 8,000 words per day. For men, it's 3,000 to 4,000 words. Your feet are bigger in the afternoon than at any other time of the day. The only two animals that can see behind themselves without turning their heads are the rabbit and the parrot. If colouring wasn't added to Coca-Cola, it would be green. It is physically impossible to lick your elbow. And don't try it while you're sitting here, okay? It'll put me off. Anyone know which one is false?
Six.
Number six. The only two animals. Number four. On average, why is that not true? What is it? 9,000? 10,000? What? Okay, I'll tell you which one isn't true up there. It's the toothbrush. The toothbrush was invented in 1498, not 1598. You all knew that, didn't you? You all know that now. All the other ones there, apparently, are true. Some people are looking at me saying, I don't believe you. And the reason I put this, a very, very tenuous weak link, this with today's talk, because I actually got that from a book called I Don't Believe It, okay? So, and I thought it was just a bit of a good way to start, so put it off now. And also, and this is why this link is so bad, is because it taps into what happened with the resurrection, because when it happened, the disciples didn't believe it as well. I know that's bad, isn't it? Today is our fourth Sunday looking at the resurrection of Jesus. And today is also the end of our series in Luke's Gospel, which actually began 15 months ago. So we're befittingly finished with the Gospel today, with Luke's account of the resurrected Christ. Now, when it comes to writing about the resurrection, Luke actually has got a lot of material. But like the other gospel writers, when it comes to the resurrection, he selects what he wants to say. That's why you have to come and harmonize the gospels when it comes to the resurrection. They all select certain things, and what we have to do is piece it together. Luke wrote another book in the New Testament, the book of Acts. And at the beginning of that book, he writes that Jesus appeared to his disciples over 40 days. So what Luke does, he selects. And in the last chapter of his gospel, he records three encounters that Jesus had. And these three encounters act as evidence of the resurrection. Obviously, Luke felt that these encounters were significant and they actually could stand on their own. There's no need to record any more. Now, what's notable is that each encounter has got the same format. That's something that Lyndon highlighted a couple of weeks ago when we looked at the road to Emmaus. And I'll briefly recap what these three formats are. The three formats in all three encounters is this. First, a group of disciples are in great trouble. They're frightened, they're bewildered, they're perplexed. They're still reeling, if you like, under the shock and the dark shadow of the previous Friday. Secondly, someone comes, rebukes them gently, and gives instruction and explains what is happening. And thirdly, the disciples are no longer bewildered, and they're actually transformed with this newfound understanding about Jesus, and they've got renewed confidence. So just look at how Luke 24 is structured. In the first encounter, the women come to the tomb to embalm the body of Jesus. They find the stone is rolled away. There's no body, and we're told that they're bewildered. Two angels arrive and ask that great question, why do you look for the living among the dead? He is not here, he has risen. The women then run back to tell the male disciples, who actually don't believe the women's words. They say it's a load of nonsense. In the second encounter, on the road to Emmaus, you've got the same pattern. There's two disciples and they're downcast. They're disappointed, they're despondent. Jesus comes alongside them, but actually we're told that they don't actually recognize him. They tell him about what had happened that morning, and he then rebukes them for their unbelief and goes on to explain all the scriptures say about himself. And then while they're eating a meal, Jesus breaks bread and he reveals who he is to them at that point. Their eyes are open to see him, and in their excitement, they go running back to Jerusalem to tell the other disciples. So we're going to pick up the account of the first day from this point, and we're going to focus on the third encounter this morning. And we're going to start by reading verses 33 to 35, and then we'll read the part where it says Jesus appears to his disciples. So we're at the point where after the second encounter, the two disciples who have seen Jesus after he breaks bread, they're going now back to Jerusalem. It says this, 33 to 35. They got up and returned at once to Jerusalem. There they found the 11 and those with them assembled together and saying, "It is true, the Lord has risen and has appeared to Simon." Then the two told what had happened on the way and how Jesus was recognized by them when he broke the bread. So the two disciples, they run back, they go back to Jerusalem. They go back to the house where probably the Last Supper happened, and actually the same place that probably was going to be the meeting place for the church in the days to come. And when they go back, this is the first day, they begin to talk about what had happened and what a day it was of conflicting emotion on that first Easter Sunday. The women have found an empty tomb. They then hear the news that Christ is risen. They then go and tell the men who are totally skeptical and unbelieving. But some go down to the tomb and they find it's empty. And we're actually told on the first day Jesus also appeared to Simon Peter. Then into this gathering burst the two from Emmaus, and they give this detailed account of their encounter with the risen Christ. Then, as they were talking about these things, Luke gives us the third part of his resurrection account. So let's read verses 36 to 49. This is the third account that Luke gives us of Jesus appearing to the disciples. Verse 36. While they were still talking about this, Jesus himself stood among them and said to them, "Peace be with you." They were startled and frightened, thinking they'd seen a ghost. He said to them, "Why are you troubled, and why do doubts rise in your minds? Look at my hands and my feet. It is I myself. Touch me and see. A ghost does not have flesh and bones, as you see that I have." And when he had said this, he showed them his hands and his feet. And while they still did not believe it because of joy and amazement, he asked them, "Do you have anything here to eat?" And they gave him a piece of broiled fish. And he took it and he ate it in their presence. And he said to them, "This is what I told you while I was still with you. Everything must be fulfilled that is written about me in the law of Moses, the prophets, and the Psalms." And he opened their minds so they could understand the scriptures. He told them, "This is what is written. The Christ will suffer and rise from the dead on the third day. And repentance and forgiveness of sins will be preached in his name to all nations, beginning at Jerusalem. You are witnesses of these things. I am going to send you what my Father has promised. But stay in the city until you have been clothed with power from on high." Now, what an amazing mix of emotions there is when Jesus appears to them. We're told that the disciples believe, but they also don't believe. They're startled and afraid, but we're also told that they're joyful. And you get all those emotions all at once. So what does Jesus do to allay their fears and to give them understanding? Well, the first thing Jesus does, he comes in, it says that he says to them, "Peace be with you." But we're told the disciples are frightened. The disciples are frightened because they think they're looking at a ghost. So was this just a spiritual manifestation? In some ways, is Jesus just coming back as an apparition with some message of comfort and assurance? At this point, this is what the disciples think. They think they're looking at a ghost. And I have to say, some people say today, Jesus didn't come back physically from the dead. It was a spiritual resurrection. It's not about flesh and bones. But this idea is dismissed by the gospel writers. Luke records that Jesus, to show it was a bodily resurrection, actually does two things. And let's think about the significance of these things now. Firstly, he says to them, "Why are you troubled, and why do doubts come into your mind? Look at my hands and my feet." Why does he do this? He does this because they're marked by the cross. He does this to show that the one who was crucified was also the one who is now risen. And it raises this question: why wasn't Jesus' resurrected body free of scars and wounds? It obviously was a different body, but it's not free of the scars and the wounds. Let's just think about that for a moment. What do wounds represent? Well, wounds are evidence of suffering. They reveal injuries that result from being bruised and broken, whether it's physically or emotionally. To be human is to be wounded. All of us here have experienced something that in some way leaves a wound. Now, the wounds of Jesus represent his suffering and his death, but they also represent to us his gift of love. That love that was willing to go and experience such suffering, Jesus showed them his wounds and he said to them, "Peace be with you." He's reminding them that he is actually the crucified one. And he's also reminded them how he actually secured that peace for us. Now, you may be familiar with this prophecy about Jesus in the Old Testament. It's from the book of Isaiah, and it's written about Jesus hundreds of years before the event. And Isaiah wrote this: "He was pierced for our transgressions. He was crushed for our iniquities. The punishment that brought us peace was upon him, and by his wounds we are," what? Healed. We know it. By his wounds we are healed. Now that is an amazing statement. It's an amazing statement because what it's saying is the death of God's Son can bring forgiveness to sinful people, but also it can bring healing and hope to those who suffer and are in despair. And just as he came to the disciples who, let's be honest, who failed him and were now confused and doubting, and says to them, "Accept my gift of peace," so he comes to us now and he says exactly the same thing. Through his wounds, we can be reconciled to God, and we can also know hope and peace because of the transforming power of the resurrection. Now, the knowledge that God comes to us, of course, doesn't eliminate or protect us from suffering. But what it can do is transform and change us. And it can give us cause to have hope. Philip Yancey, in his book, The Jesus I Never Knew, a very, very good book, I recommend this, still read it years on. Very good chapter on the resurrection. And he talks about the scars that Jesus had. Sums it up very well. I'll read you this. "One detail in the Easter stories that has always intrigued me. Why did Jesus keep the scars from his crucifixion? Presumably, he could have had any resurrected body he wanted, and yet he chose one identifiable mainly by scars that could be seen and touched. Why? Well, I believe the story of Easter would be incomplete without those scars on the hands, the feet, and the side of Jesus. When human beings fantasize, we dream of pearly straight teeth, wrinkle-free skin, and sexy ideal shapes. We dream of an unnatural state, the perfect body. But for Jesus, being confined in a skeleton and human skin was the unnatural state. The scars are to him the emblem of life on our planet, a permanent reminder of those days of confinement and suffering. And I take hope in Jesus' scars. From the perspective of heaven, they represent the most horrible event that has ever happened in the history of the universe. Even that event, though, Easter turned into a memory. Because of Easter, I can hope that the tears we shed, the blows we receive, the emotional pain, the heartache over lost friends and loved ones, all these will become memories like Jesus' scars. Scars never go completely away, but neither in the end do they hurt any longer. We will have recreated bodies. There will be a recreated heaven and earth. We will have a new start, and it will be an Easter start. Interestingly, Luke records that even after he showed them his hands and his feet, they still didn't believe. So the second thing that Jesus does to show his disciples and us now that he was no ghost was that he actually just ate some broiled fish. Now, ghosts don't eat fish. An apparition cannot make food disappear. And Luke records this, I think, because he's reassuring us this was not just a spiritual, it was also a physical resurrection. But this body is now wonderfully transformed. It's no longer limited by time and place. And on that first Easter Sunday, it's a sign, actually, of a new order and a new creation. 72 hours after Jesus had died on a cross, he wanted the disciples to know this. Everything had changed. A new era had actually just begun. Look again at the first verse of chapter 24. It says this: on the first day of the week, very early in the morning, the women took spices they had prepared and went to the tomb. Now let me quote you the opening of the resurrection account of the other three Gospels, just the first sentences from Matthew, Mark and John. Now this isn't rocket science, just see what they all repeat. They all say the same thing. This is in Matthew. After the Sabbath at dawn on the first day of the week, Mary Magdalene and the other Mary went to look at the tomb. This is from Mark. Very early on the first day of the week, just after sunrise, they were on their way to the tomb. Hopefully you're still with me. John says this. Early on the first day of the week, while it was still dark, Mary Magdalene went to the tomb. What is the thing that all four gospel writers put in their first sentence on the resurrection? On the first day of the week. Every one of them says, on the first day of the week. It's emphasized at the start of each account. So is it significant? I think it is, because it indicates that actually this is the beginning of a new era. It's the start of a new order. Now, it might appear as if death still reigns, but its back has been broken, its sting has now gone. The resurrection of Jesus means this. It means a new era has actually begun. We still live in a broken world, but for the Christian believer, the resurrection gives us the great hope of the promise of the world that is to come. I mentioned last week of some famous things written on people's tombstones. I really like the story of an old woman in rural Louisiana in America who requested that when she died, she be buried under an oak tree in a cemetery with only one word carved on the tombstone, which is this: waiting. Waiting. She understood what the resurrection of Jesus meant. Anyway, back to Luke. One thing that has struck me afresh just from reading his resurrection account, and hopefully it's an encouragement to us, is the amazing patience of Christ. There's Jesus. He stands among his disciples, and their response to him is, well, he must be a ghost. So he says, no, look at my hands and my feet, but they still don't believe after that. So then he looks at them and says, okay, give me something to eat. We sing Amazing Grace, but we should also be aware, I think, of the amazing patience of Christ. It permeates all the way through Luke chapter 24 and also throughout the 40 days of his resurrection and before his ascension. And it's a reminder to us all that Christ is patient with us. And he's patient with us in our perplexities and our problems and our confusions. If you think about it, the disciples had failed Jesus, they'd abandoned him, they didn't understand all that he had taught them. But what does he do? He comes back for them. He didn't give up with them. He's very patient with them, and that is a lesson for us all. But also note verse 45, it says, then he, Jesus, opened their minds so they could understand the scriptures. And that's the hope of every preacher, that minds would be opened and that the scriptures would be understood. And the fact is, we needn't stay confused and perplexed. Our hearts and our minds needn't remain overshadowed with doubt. But I think we do need help if our minds are going to open up to really receive understanding, which is why we should always come humbly and prayerfully when we open the scriptures and we read them, whether that's individually or as we are now meeting together. So we come to the end of Luke's gospel. But in some ways, it's not an end. It would have been really strange if Luke had laid down his pen and left it at that. But we know he took it up again and he began to write about what happened as the result of Good Friday and Easter Sunday. And we read in the book of Acts the story of the birth of the church and then how the gospel spread. Winston Churchill is a great source for quotes. Someone said about him that he spent a lot of time and thought just working on impromptu speeches. During one important juncture in the Second World War, he said this: this is not the end. It's not even the beginning of the end. But perhaps it is now the end of the beginning. And I think at the end of Luke, we can say this: at this point in the New Testament, it's the end of the beginning. For from this point, the first disciples are now ready to go out and preach repentance and forgiveness of sins, and they start in Jerusalem, but then that spreads to all nations. As the Son of God came into the world to bring the message of salvation, so now he tells his people to go out and bring that same message. So let's finish by reading Luke's ending, and it's verses 50 to 53, and then you have my word on this for the time being. We are finished with Luke's gospel, okay? The ascension, it says this: when he had led them out to the vicinity of Bethany, he lifted up his hands and blessed them. And while he was blessing them, he left them and was taken up into heaven. Then they worshipped him and returned to Jerusalem with great joy. And they stayed continually at the temple, praising God. Very interesting, I think, that Luke chooses to finish his gospel where he began, and that is in the temple with God's people praising God. But this is a different temple now, because a new way has been opened for God and his people to be united, a new way to worship. At the end of Luke's gospel, there's a new temple. The actual building was doomed to destruction, but the temple now is God's new community that responds to and proclaims forgiveness, mercy, and grace of God that is found in Christ Jesus. So we get to the end of Luke's gospel, the end of chapter 24, but the story continues. And if you like, it continues now, because we're all called to be part of the story that Luke began to write.